good afternoon and welcome to Conversations. This is your host, Michael Stone. We have a very special and important show today, so I'm glad you're listening. If for some reason you don't get to hear the whole show, please go to our site tomorrow. Just Google Conversations with Michael Stone so you can send this show to your friends, and I will tell you all about it in just a minute. But I want to thank those of you who pledged last week. We had a wonderful outpouring of support on our pledge drive show last week with David White. And I just want to thank you, the listener, for your ongoing support of Conversations. I also want to thank Sacramento Natural Food Co-op's presenting the class Roasted Winter Vegetable Recipes, wherein participants learn to prepare onion thyme tartlets, butternut squash gratin, and goat cheese, and more. Saturday, October 24th at 3:30 p.m., complete class schedule at sacfoodcoop.com. Also, Pathways to Health, a holistic healing center established in 1986, located off I-80 in Auburn, featuring a collective of independent massage therapists offering a variety of modalities with steam and sauna included. That's Pathways to Help. Pathways to Health, which is at 530-888-6534. Well, we're going to talk about the environment today, given that we're coming up to Copenhagen in December, and get people thinking about this. I have some real concerns, and that's why I asked you to send this on. I want to give you some numbers here as we start. You probably don't know it, but 57%, only 57% of Americans actually believe that we have a climate crisis. That is down 30% from 3 years ago when it was 87%. This is a problem. It is the only country in the world that's going backwards in the climate race thing, and that's because there's been a massive campaign throughout United States to confuse the issue, and the media has certainly had a lot of help. So you're listening to community radio. We're not going to confuse the issue. We're going to tell you about the 4% of the population here in the United States that produces 25% of the CO2. That's only in this country. That doesn't include all the factories and ways that we create pollution in other countries. So we're going to focus today on Lester Brown's new book. And Lester couldn't make it to be here this year, but his right hand, Janet Larson, is here. She's the director of research for the Earth Policy Institute, working with Lester on Plan B 4.0 and all the other Plan Bs going back a number of years. It's about mobilizing to save civilization. She's also the co-author of the Earth Policy Reader, and she's written on topics ranging from natural resources availability to population growth and climate change. You can find out more about Earth Policy Institute by going to www.earthpolicy.org. Also in the studio with me is our friend Matthew Stein, author of the wonderful book When Technology Fails, A Manual for Self-Reliance, Sustainability, and Surviving the Long Emergency. So it's great to have you both here. Welcome to Conversations.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Pleasure to be back on your show.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. And Janet, this is the first time you've been on the show, but we are very pleased to have you here, and also grateful for the amazing work that you've been doing. If I had any one book that I would tell people they must have and they must read, it is Plan B 4.0, Mobilizing to Save Civilization. And I want to tell people right off that you can actually download this for free from the site earthpolicy.org. So, Janet, this new edition here focuses on the issue of food. So I'd like to start out talking about where are we in the current state of the world in regards to food. Can you give us a little overview of the issues as we start this show?
Certainly. Well, we have some good news and some bad news. For a number of years following World War II, the number and the share of hungry people in the world was actually dropping. We were making progress on hunger, but the world's nations got together and said, this is a priority for us. We want to make sure that everybody in the world has access to good quality, safe and nutritious food. And we were making some progress there. Unfortunately, the decline in the number of hungry people in the world hit bottom in the mid-1990s and has started to climb up. And in the last 2 years, when we saw a tripling of world grain prices between 2006 and 2008, we actually had the number of hungry people in the world spike up to over 1 billion people. So over 1 billion of us around the world cannot access a safe and nutritious meal every day. This is bad news for us as a global society. It means the trend's moving in the wrong direction. And so what we wanted to do is look at this in context of all the other environmental, social, and economic trends that we're looking at worldwide and see where we're going.
And so many of those issues, we don't notice them here. I think that's one of the problems is, you know, if you were in Australia, you would notice the fact that in a year, Adelaide won't have any water in the city, the dust bowls and the fires and the heating up and the sea rises around the world. We've had our little Katrina, which wasn't little, of course, but we seem to be numb from that. But when we look at the state of the world, what goes into food? Well, we've got water, primary, before you think of anything else. So what about the state of water?
Well, the world's use of water has tripled since 1950, largely because now we have electrical pumps and diesel pumps that can pull water from underground sources that before we couldn't access. 70% of the water that is used around the world goes to irrigation. It goes to agriculture. So anything that affects the world's water prospects affects the world's food prospects. With using these underground sources of water, it's really an invisible problem when you start to overpump. But we are seeing that water tables are falling in many of the world's major food producers, namely China, India, and even here in the United States. We're drilling the water out from underground faster than it can be replenished. In some cases, these underground sources of water called aquifers are actually fossil aquifers. They can't be replenished by rainfall. So once you drill that water out, once you pump that water out, you can no longer irrigate your crops. Now, new numbers from the World Bank imply that over 175 million people in India are being fed with grain produced from overpumped aquifers. So this is a sort of we've heard about the housing bubble. Here we have a food bubble. All these people are getting fed with water that we can't guarantee will be there for much longer in the future. For China, the figure is harder to come by, but we estimate that about 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain irrigated by overpumping wells. And you can look around the world and see a similar problem in Iran, in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia. There's a very interesting announcement from Saudi Arabia back in early 2008. And the Saudi government said, because we don't have the water supplies that had been made available through very heavy government subsidies to grow wheat in the desert, they acknowledged that this water, this aquifer, was running out, and they would actually discontinue farming wheat in the desert, cutting back their planting by about one-eighth per year, so that by 2016, Saudi Arabia would be producing no wheat and would be fully dependent on world market for imports.
Mm. Now, what's the impact on water, just taking that one issue, of the way we're growing crops, the monocultures, the heavy meat diet, and also I see that many farmers are selling their water to industry because it's worth a lot more a ton of steel than a ton of grain. Can you comment on that?
Exactly. When you look at the economics of water, industry wins out almost all the time. Cities can afford to pay much more for water supplies than farmers can. So here you have in California, nearly every month there's sales of water access from farmers to cities, Los Angeles being one of the major purchasers of water that will no longer be used to grow food in the Central Valley, but will go to people's taps and swimming pools in Los Angeles. When you look at people's personal consumption of water, on average around the world, people drink about 2 liters of water per day. Now you think, well, that's not very much, and it isn't. That's a pretty small number. But if you look at the water it takes to produce the food we eat, it's 500 times as much. So if we're drinking 2 liters of water per day, we're drinking over 1,000 liters of water per day in the food we eat. And that number goes much higher, of course, if you are a heavy meat consumer.
What is the difference between the water we use for meat versus grain?
Well, it takes about 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain. So right there you can see why 70% of all water use is going to food production. It's a very thirsty endeavor to farm. So you have 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain. But for every pound of meat you want to get, you need about 6 or 7 or 8 times as much grain. So, let me break this down maybe more simply. It takes about 6, 7, 8 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. If you're looking at pork, it's more like 4 or 5. Chicken, a little bit less. Farmed fish is about 2 pounds of grain for every pound of meat. So you can see if it takes 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain, you can see how it multiplies up quickly if you have a heavy diet, heavy in red meat.
That's great. I'm keeping Matt in the background for the solution area here. But Matt, anything you wanted to say about water in general?
You know, one of the things I wanted to mention is that I believe it's something like 16% of the world's cropland is irrigated. But 40% of that cropland, that 16% of land that's irrigated produces 40% of our food. So we're running into a situation where when people say, oh, well, you know, the ground's being overpumped, well, what does that mean? That means that if we continue this trend, then those billionaire people roughly that are being fed now from irrigated, overpumped sources won't be fed because that water, when it's gone, it's not being replaced. So anything that's overpumped, it's eventually gone. Just like happened in Saudi Arabia, it's happening all over the world, in India, wells running dry. So you're looking at a future where failed states, and I'm sure Janet's going to get into that shortly, but you're going to see failed states all over the world. And that destabilization with all of those angry, hungry, desperate people unleashed on the world, that's a very nasty Mad Max kind of future if we don't do the right thing.
Yeah. Well said. What about, let's take a little bit of a side tack here, still looking at food and water, but let's talk about privatization of both water and land, which will open up the door for looking at our soil. Tell us a little bit about what's happening there with water and land in some of these places. Who's owning it? Not the commons.
Well, farmers and natural systems are losing out to development almost everywhere you look around the world, where we have our cities expanding, corporations growing factories where there used to be farms. This is probably most severe and egregious in China, where so much of the formerly prime arable land is now being used either for roads, because roads are on farmland, are a natural fit, it's nicely flat slope land, or for city developments, or for industry. And if the industry is not right on top of the farmland, it may be making that farmland unusable by contaminating the soil so much that it's just no longer safe to grow food there, or food won't even be able to grow. So So we have our farmland getting turned into cities and industries. We also have our natural systems, our forests and our grasslands, suffering from the encroachment of a world population that's growing by 79 million people each year. So the amount of free open space is certainly falling.
And what about the land grabs by the wealthier Western countries? Well, not only the Western countries, but the wealthier countries.
Well, this is one of the newest phenomena that we talk about in Plan B 4.0. What we've seen in the past several years with the rise of food prices is that food importing countries, their first response to higher food prices is to try to nail down imports, so that you may have bilateral agreements from between countries like Vietnam and Indonesia to secure a rice lifeline to make sure that there's enough importable supplies. We also have grain-producing countries when there's higher world market prices, and they're seeing higher prices on the ground. They may put export embargoes, which just tends to worsen the scenario because then there's less food out there to be bought and sold. But this third response that is relatively new is countries now, instead of just using the world market for grain supplies, they're starting to purchase large parcels of land in other countries where they can bring in farmers, develop agriculture, and import that food back home. And this has been done historically, of course, when you look at colonialism, but most often it's for crops like sugar or pineapples. This is the first time we've seen it on such a massively large scale for basic staple foods like wheat. So we have countries like Saudi Arabia, for instance, setting up meetings with a number of countries in Latin America, in Africa, where they're purchasing or leasing land. We had China approach the Philippines for a lease of a land parcel that would be equal to 10% of the Philippines' rice land. That word got out to farmers, and there was so much uproar that is now off the books, but that doesn't mean that China has stopped trying to look elsewhere to see where you can get land. Probably the most popularized case study was when a South Korean company, Daewoo, went into Madagascar to try to purchase a large parcel of Madagascar land for growing crops for food and for biofuels. And that, of course, led to was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back, that led to a change up in the government, because the people didn't want to see their land get taken away. But so many of these agreements are happening behind closed doors, and local people who may not have legal rights or specific land tenure only find out once their land has gotten taken away.
Yeah. Matt?
Yeah, I wanted to comment that action of countries kind of buying up the rest of the world, that we're used to pulling the reins as being the rich Western countries and doing that all over the world, that it's also extended to China buying mineral rights. So there's a lot of, not only are we running short on food and soils, but running short on oil, and there's key minerals and precious metals that are needed for high-tech industries, and China's going around even to America and buying up a lot of our mineral rights to guarantee themselves access to these kind of depleting materials that are required to support a high-tech society. So we're looking at a lot of strains, including food, but also these precious metals and minerals for semiconductors that they're vying for all over the world, and there's a decreasing supply. So we're looking at a future where we either coordinate the efforts and have a future we can all live with, or you're going to see some really nasty stuff coming down when industries shut down because they don't have access to the required natural resources anymore.
Good point. I want to say something to our listeners just for a second. Number one, you're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City. This is Conversations. And this particular show, you might be sitting there getting a little overwhelmed. And I want you to know, number one, this is barely the tip of the iceberg. But number two, in the end part of the show, we are going to be talking about solutions, as we always do. So hang in there with us, because this is information that we need to know, and there's very little in the media that you can find that actually gives you this information. Janet, I wanted to move to the state of our soils. That's a huge issue also, and you began to mention that. Where are we in the global picture of our soil depletion?
In too many parts of the world, soil erosion is exceeding new soil formation. It takes centuries to form new, good quality topsoil, and we unfortunately are overplowing much of the world's farmland. We're overgrazing grasslands. One interesting indicator that probably doesn't get too much attention is the rise in the population of goats in many parts of the world. Goats, yes. If you look at say, Kenya's sheep, goat, and cow population, you can see the lines crossing, where the number of goats has grown much more rapidly than cows or sheep. And in some ways, this is an indicator you'd think is it would only be interesting to agronomists, but it actually can tell us something about the soil quality. Because anybody who's ever watched a billy goat knows that they eat almost anything. Goats can climb trees to get at the last leaf. They're nowhere near as picky as sheep or cattle. So when we're turning to have larger and larger goat herds, oftentimes that can be an indicator of desperation among pastoralists.
Interesting how that takes us back 200 years to the ranchers and the goat herders and sheep herders of the big wars that happened several hundred years ago, really, or 150 years ago anyway. So, okay, let's move into another aspect of that. There's so much to cover, but I'd like to talk about the grain versus oil controversy, and particularly, there's a lot of disinformation around biofuels. I think you've got a really good handle on that. Can you speak to that, Janet?
Well, when we have the price of oil going up, it becomes much more profitable to convert grain into oil substitutes. So listeners will remember when oil prices spiked, and around that time we also had a proliferation of ethanol distilleries across the United States, many in the Midwest, scooping up more and more of the U.S. corn crop to turn into fuel for cars. This number has grown exponentially, such that this year more than a quarter of the U.S. grain crop is actually being turned into fuel for cars. This is one of the main recent pressures that helped push grain prices to record high levels last year, where they tripled for some of the grains in just a matter of months. And yet, this is one of the most easy things for us to correct. Right now, the U.S. government massively subsidizes the ethanol industry. There's a 51 cent per gallon tax credit for blending ethanol into gasoline. And there's also a mandate for a growing share of our gasoline consumption to come from ethanol. And what many people haven't realized is by subsidizing the biofuels industry, we're actually subsidizing a rise in our food prices, so that when you go to the supermarket and you pick up your packet of ground beef or ice cream, milk, yogurt, eggs, these are all products that are full of corn. So if there's more demand for corn from fuel producers, the price of these basic staples will rise. And when we've seen that here in the U.S. with prices rising, but more importantly, it affects people in low-income grain-importing countries the most, because in these developing countries, people are spending 50, 60, or 70% of their income on food, and they're often buying the grain directly. So it's the poor people that are hit the hardest by us in the United States trying to turn more food into fuel.
So what you're saying is that basically I'm going to have a choice. I can eat or I can put gas in my car in the direction it's going. And this brings up a really important aspect of the growing disparity between the rich and the poor on this planet and in this country. I think it's close to half of the people on the planet now live on less than $2 a day. Is that right?
Less than $2 a day.
Something like that.
Not quite half, but...
Yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, at least.
So let's talk about that, and let's talk about what's causing it, because there's a lot of hidden things like our subsidies and our externalized costs that we don't factor into the real food budget and the real costs of food. Can you address that, Janet?
Well, I think one thing that was pretty astonishing for us is that we calculated that filling an SUV tank with ethanol only one time would use as much corn as could feed one person for a year.
For a whole year.
That's so amazing.
Wow.
And so it's this competition is really pitting the owners of the world's 800 million automobiles against the 2 billion poorest people, sort of falling off the rungs of the economic ladder. So it's an incredibly serious issue, and that's not something that shows up in your supermarket bill at all directly. Most Americans aren't aware of the implications.
They're also not aware of the issue of food agricultural subsidies and the global impact of that. Can you speak to that?
Well, one of the most egregious agricultural subsidies, of course, is the subsidies for biofuels production. But we've seen a number of cases before the World Trade Organization where developing countries are pointing their fingers at the United States and at Europe for subsidizing grain crops, sugar crops, cotton crops, distorting world market prices and making it harder for developing country producers to make a living. So there's this strange balance between when you look at food prices. At a certain level, higher prices are good for farmers in developing countries because it means that they can get a fair price for their labor. And since they, in some developing countries, of course, you don't have the same kind of massive funding for agricultural production. They want an even playing field. They want U.S. and Europe to remove their subsidies. But at the other level, of course, you don't want grain prices to go up too high too fast, because that's what's hurting everyday consumers.
Well, there's another aspect of that that really concerns me about the subsidies. Let's say that I'm a small rice farmer in Vietnam or wherever, and someone has been subsidized here to grow rice and gets huge amounts of money to do that. So we send our rice-filled water or grain over to this particular area, which undercuts the ability of that small farmer to make a living, whereby they're forced into the city to take a factory job for the Gap or for some corporation that's there polluting their land. And that isn't even included in the 24% of the pollution that we're creating. So that to me is a crime. It's really criminal. One of the things I want to talk about also, Janet, because somebody, I'm sorry if you're calling in, I don't have time to take call-ins today. But one of the things that I wanted to talk to people, because if I were sitting home, a listener, I would say, where do they get this data? Can you tell us a little bit about your research work with Lester and what you're doing just to stop that conversation in people's heads right now?
Sure. We rely on the excellent work being done by scientists all around the world in every field imaginable, from economists to climate scientists to agronomists to those looking at water supply and availability, population growth, natural resources. So we talk to a lot of scientists, people doing development work on the ground, United Nations agencies, government work, relying on the great amount of data collected by national governments, state governments. Our library and our inboxes are full, are completely full and overflowing. So what we do is we take all these, all this work being done by experts in individual fields, and then we try to look and make the linkages to see how this is going to affect the human predicament. So one thing that a lot of climate scientists, for instance, have looked at, what are the effects of higher temperatures on plant production or crop yields. And then we take what's known about higher temperatures and crop yields, and then we take that and set it next to what we know about our water supplies, whether it's the underground water supplies that we talked about earlier, or knowing that more than 1 billion people in Asia are actually very reliant on river flow from the major rivers that are fed in the dry season largely by glacier melt. Now, we know that these glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau are melting at increasingly rapid rates. So then we try to pair that with the climate science on crop yields, what we know about underground water supplies, and see what could happen when if these glaciers, which the Chinese Academy of Science estimates could, two-thirds of them could be lost by 2060, what does that mean for food supplies? And then we're always looking for solutions and success stories, and that's the good thing about Plan B, is that we really have an action plan, how we can multiply the success stories that we see in many parts of the world and scale them up at wartime speed.
Yes, indeed you do have a plan. I want to talk about that in just a minute. If you were listening closely, what Janet said, there was one thing that you took as an assumption in the beginning that I just want to, if anyone was listening carefully, that's assuming that temperatures are going up, and there is no question about that. Give us just over the last 10 years, what's happened with climate temperatures, whether it's from fossil fuels, which there's enormous evidence that we need to scale back to 350 parts per million by 2020, which is a big part of Plan B. But give us a little background in the temperature rise, because we're dealing with so many people who have been misinformed about this issue.
Globally, temperatures have risen by about 0.7 degrees Celsius over the last 40 years. The overwhelming reason for this rise in temperatures is that we are burning more and more fossil fuels, thus pumping more and more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which end up trapping heat, warming the planet. This is one thing that the scientists now, they take what's happened already and then they try to project out what happens in the future. Now, if you look at business as usual projections, if we continue to burn more and more fossil fuels, that's coal, oil, natural gas, as well as chopping down forests or burning forests and releasing that those greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we're looking at a rise in temperature of this century up to about 6.4 degrees Celsius or 11 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if you think on a day-to-day basis, you know, sometimes you wake up in the morning and the temperature rises 11 degrees during the day.
You like it sometimes.
Yes. You know, that's no big deal. But what we're talking about, these are global average temperatures, and that is putting us outside of a range that this planet has known in 15 million years. So this is taking us completely out of anything that humanity has known. Our agricultural system has only been in existence for about 11,000 years, and those 11,000 years were remarkably stable in climate. So a 6 or 11 degree Fahrenheit rise in temperature during the century is disastrous.
That's,
at best.
It doesn't, when you start at 0.7 degrees Celsius, it doesn't sound like much, but when you realize that this is something that's exponentially growing, and as is the destruction of the ice and the land and the oceans, and the ability for the temperature to regulate itself, then it does sound like something very major. Let's talk about Plan B. We need about 5 hours to really talk about this. One thing I also wanted to say, your index is somewhere around 100 pages of the resources. So if someone questions the resources, just go to the back of Plan B 4.0 in the current edition, and you can find out what kind of resources Janet is quoting here. And she is the head director of research for Earth Policy Institute, and basically co-authors this with Lester Brown, although I know his name is on it, and he's been doing this for a long time. So Plan B says four things. Let's talk about each of them. One of them we mentioned, 80% reduction in carbon by 2020. The second is 8 billion population. Where are we right now? We want to levelize it at 8 billion. We'll talk about that. Poverty eradication as a key element, and restoring the natural Earth systems on the planet. So let's talk about part one, Janet. 80% reduction in carbon by 2020. What is the United States proposing now going into the Copenhagen Accords?
Well, it hasn't been decided what the U.S. would argue for in Copenhagen, but if you look at the climate bills that are in the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate right now, they're talking about reductions in emissions of 17% or 20%. But here's the difference.
But that's by 2050, isn't it?
That would be the 2020 number.
Oh, that is the 2020 number. Okay.
But here's the difference between what they're doing in Congress and what we're looking at Earth Policy Institute. You talk to anybody on Capitol Hill, and they say, we're trying to figure out what's politically feasible, what kind of bill we can actually have a chance of having passed. And that's the reality where they live. But when we tried to figure out what goal we should be aiming for, we weren't asking what's politically feasible. We were asking what is necessary to give us the best chance of stabilizing global climate and saving the ice sheets on both poles, Greenland and the West Antarctic ice sheet, preventing sea level rise that could inundate most of the world's low-lying coastal cities and flood out the homes of 600 million people. So we didn't say what's politically feasible. We said what is necessary. And that's how we came up with our goal to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2020. And of course, is this ambitious? Yes, it's incredibly ambitious, but it is indeed possible.
Well, we might come back to that, but I want to make sure we get through the whole plan. So let's talk about how are you going to levelize population? This is an area that most people don't even want to talk about and add into the equation, and yet it's the second major bullet in your plan.
Well, stabilizing population is incredibly crucial, yet the tools for doing so are remarkably simple. There are over 200 million women around the world who want to plan out the size of their families or control how many births they have, yet they have no access to family planning or reliable contraceptives. Putting contraceptives or planning family planning education into the laps of those women will do wonders for stabilizing population. And one of the keys to doing so is educating girls. Study after study and country after country has shown that the more education girls have, the fewer children they end up having. And so this is a goal that we can be behind for humanitarian reasons, but also for environmental reasons. It makes sense to allow these women to control their fertility and plan their families.
Yes. And then right along with that is, of course, poverty alleviation.
Without reducing poverty, it will be very, very difficult, if not possible, to reach our other social goals of preserving the environment or stabilizing the climate. It's just
why is that?
They go hand in hand. If you're poor, you're desperate. You're not going to care if you're cutting down the last tree, if it's a tree that will allow you to get fuel wood to cook a meal for your family. You're not going to when you're in a desperate situation. You're looking at the here and now. You're not looking at the long term. And I think one of the biggest problems we have is that so many of our policies and so many of our actions are done in a very short-sighted way, looking at the here and now, the today, the yesterday, maybe the tomorrow, but not looking down to future generations. And so getting people to reasonable income levels where they can meet their basic needs, they can feed themselves, will make it much easier for them to start taking better care of the natural systems that are really sustaining them.
What's the percentage of people that own half the wealth in the world?
Percentage of people that own half the wealth in the world. I don't have that figure.
It's less than 1%. I know that.
Yeah, it's a tiny, tiny fraction.
Of 1%. I just wanted to make that point as we were talking about it. Matt, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I wanted to say that changing this, you know, getting Plan B going is really a matter of survival. It's not just, oh, a bunch of eco-greens want to do the right thing. That the world as we know it will not survive Plan A, which is business as usual, and that there is simply no profit to be made on a dead planet. So a lot of this is waking yourself up, waking your friends up, and really making a movement. And I know we're getting into solutions, but I just wanted to say that this is the single most important thing anyone can talk about, think about, or act on in their life.
It truly is, and it's really a shame that we've had a small number of corporate interests with a lot of money, and we'll talk about that in another show about the cover up and how that's happened. But this is real. This is very real. And you can't blame our politicians. I want to say that because it's really easy to point your finger out there, but the only thing that makes politicians move is the will of the people. ultimately. That's what gets them in. I don't care how much money is around. It really is that. So this is something that all of us that are listening can do something about. It is not out of our hands. I want to continue to finish the fourth point, which is restoring the natural earth systems. Talk a little bit about that, and then let's get into a little dialogue around what the individual can do. Janet, can you go over that last point?
Well, as Matt just said, you know, you can't make profit from a dead planet. All of our economic wealth comes from nature. When you look at the root of it, it comes from our natural resources, whether it's the water that's available on this planet, that's the same water that the dinosaurs once drank, whether you're looking at our forests, which help purify that water, hold soils down so they're not washed away in a rainstorm, our mineral wealth, our oil wealth, these are all our natural resources, and that's really what our economies are built on. We did a book several years back called Eco-Economy, looking at how the world needs to embrace a real paradigm shift, because many people think of, you know, the environment as sort of a subsector of the economy, and the economy the overriding force, and how backwards is that? It's our environment that's sustaining our economic systems, and without a healthy environment, we find that we really can't sustain economic growth. In Plan B 4.0, we talk about our Ponzi economy, how we have been continuously undermining our asset base and creating this false illusion of wealth. When really, if you're overusing all your natural capital, you really have nothing, and that wealth cannot be sustained for very long. So collapse is inevitable if you continue down that road.
And we don't really deal with, this is what I was talking about with the externalized costs, we don't really pay attention to the health costs, the air costs, the degradation costs. These are not involved. These are passed on to the commons, really. But when we look at a product that we go in and we buy for a couple dollars, an electronic gadget or something, the real cost of that, if you took it, you know, the entire cost of it would be 10 times that because of the impact on our natural systems.
Exactly. And this is what economists, they call externalities, and they recognize that this is a market failure, that when you go to buy a gallon of gasoline to put into your car, you're not paying the full cost of burning that gallon of gasoline. You're not paying for the climate disruption from the carbon emissions on burning that gasoline. You're not paying for the health care costs of treating people with respiratory ailments from breathing in the air that gallon of gasoline is polluting. And so if you take some of the best estimates, which are quite conservative, of how much that gallon of gasoline would really cost, you see that all those external costs we're not paying now add up to close to $12 per gallon of gasoline. So if you add that to the $3 or so you're paying at the pump, a true cost might be closer to $15 a gallon.
Yes. Well, we've only got about 5 minutes left here, and Matt wrote a wonderful book, When Technology Fails, a manual for sustainability, self-reliance, and surviving the long emergency. This is not a scare book, but Matt has a lot of solutions, as do you, Janet. So I want to open it this last 5 minutes to talk about what the individual can do. Like I said, creating the individual people's will is the most important thing to push us, and it's right now, with a month away before the Copenhagen Accords. So I want to really hit this home. The more letters we write and the more involved we are in the next month, the more that we're going to have our president go to Copenhagen when he accepts the Nobel Prize and come with something real to the table. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I want to stress that the solutions to solving the world's problems are large governmental solutions. But to make that happen is an individual. Every individual counts. You know, when when Lincoln ended slavery, it took millions and millions of Americans who said that this is an evil that must be stopped to make it a priority and put someone in office. And the only way that Plan B will happen and our world will avoid collapse is if we do the same thing. It's got to be each and every one of us. Naturally, you do your part, you do your recycling, you eat less meat, you try to reduce your impact, your carbon footprint. That's part of spreading the awareness. That's part of waking yourself and your neighbor up and saying, okay, we each do our small part, but now we're going to band together and we're going to make this happen. That there is no more important thing that our government can be doing than working on changing the way we do business to save the world.
Janet?
Exactly. I agree entirely. As Lester Brown says in the book, saving civilization is not a spectator sport. That means everybody has to get involved, whether it's educating yourself on environmental issues, spreading the world through word, through letters to the editor, op-ed, all the things you can do now on the internet, and get politically involved. Let your elected officials know what's important. You know, we sometimes say, you know, you can change your light bulbs at home, but make sure that if your leaders aren't working for you, change them too. And I think that's the crucial thing. Let them know what's important. On the individual action front, though, some of those actions that do seem small, they can add up. I mentioned the light bulb example. We know that if you switch out an incandescent light bulb to a compact fluorescent bulb, you can cut electricity use by 75%. If you multiply that around the globe and we switch to compact fluorescents or high efficiency light bulbs, we could reduce total world electricity use by 12%. Now that's enough to close over 700 of the world's 2,400 coal-fired power plants. You know, that adds up, and that's big saving. So energy efficiency is one of the things that we need everybody to get involved with.
One of the things I really want to get across to people is there is nothing in this plan that can't be done. All the technology is there. Everything is in place. The only thing that's missing is the will to make it happen. Matt?
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, some people say, well, where do I start? Well, you know, this is the little pitch for my book, but at the end of each chapter, I have a resource guide, and I give many reviews, and I also try to summarize the best of the world's eco-writing. So if you want to start someplace, pick it up, go to the end, read the chapters, go to the end and say, okay, what does Matt say is the best thing in the world to teach me about this subject, and do it. You know, waking yourself up, it's not much fun. Doing the research for this part of my book was really kind of a bummer. I'd always thought of myself as being Mr. Eco and Mr. Green and really knowing what this stuff was all about. But I must admit, when I read everything that I read to put together my book, I realized we're much closer to collapse than I had ever imagined. Now, sticking your head in the sand and saying, well, what can I do? I'm just one person. I'm just going to have a good time and forget about that. That's a sure recipe for collapse. Waking yourself up, being proactive, saying, I am going to do what I can for my own small impact, and I'm going to do what I can to be part of this conscious shift in the planet. That's the key to making this happen.
Yeah. Anything else before we close here, Janet? I just, there's so much more to talk about, but I'd like to, any last things you'd like to tell our listening audience?
Right now, we're in a race, and this is a race between tipping points in our natural systems and in our political systems. So can people push the politicians to make the changes needed to stabilize climate, stabilize population, eradicate poverty, and restore the Earth's damaged ecosystems fast enough to beat out the changes that are happening in the natural systems? Well, that's the big question for our generation today. Will we phase out coal-fired power plants fast enough to stop the accelerating melting of Greenland ice sheet before it hits the point of no return? Can we slow deforestation in the Amazon before it dries out so much it's vulnerable to fire? These are the tipping points we're looking at, and that's why we need everybody to get behind Plan B and push in the right direction so that our tipping points can beat out these negative trends we set in motion.
And again, I want to say that you can get Plan B 4.0 by downloading it for free from the internet at worldwatch.org. earthpolicy.org. Is that right?
Earthpolicy.org.
I'm sorry. Had a little flashback there. And so you can download it, but you can also support the organization by buying the book, which is another way to do that too. So if you'd like to do that, but all of this is online, available for free, and please pass it on to all your friends. Janet, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know how busy you are, and I just appreciate it. Our listeners appreciate your taking the time to be with this. I don't know if you're going to be in Copenhagen, but if so, I'll see you there.
I will be there, so looking forward to it.
We'll have to hook up. Thanks so much
thank
for
you.
Being on Conversations. And Matt, it's just always a joy to have you around, and you're a tireless environmentalist, and any last words you'd like to tell our listeners?
Sure. And my motto is I urge everyone to do your best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And so go on out, don't be bummed about this, take action. That's the best way to transform your being upset about the environment is to take action, to move forward and to say, we can do this. And I believe we can change the world and we can save the world. This is not undoable. This is doable.
Thanks so much, Matt. And Matt's book is When Technology Fails. It's a must read, as is Plan B 4.0. So thank you all for listening. This is Michael Stone for Conversations, and we will be back next week with Mariana Kaplan talking about having discernment on the spiritual path, cultivating discernment. The reason I say that is if you have an environmental issue, it's going to be a social issue, because where are they going to dump it? Where are they going to blow the smoke? It's not in the higher class neighborhoods. It's in the people that are disenfranchised. And if you have that happening, you have a spiritual issue at its heart. So that's why we cover all three on Conversations. I also wanted you to know, we have a lot of great people coming up. I can't even go through them. Joanna Macy and on and on and on. You can go to just Google Conversations with Michael Stone. Send me a message. Go to listen. You can find this interview on Conversations with Michael Stone or arewelistening.net. Send it to all your friends. At least give them a little primer on what's really happening here. We will have someone on talking about the issue of cover-up very soon. I want to thank our underwriter, Sacramento Natural Foods Co-op, presenting the class Fall Family Favorites, wherein participants learn to prepare cheddar cheese, ale soup, pumpkin croissant, butter, pudding, and more. Monday, October 26th at 6:30, complete class schedule at sacfoodcoop.com. Also, Pathways to Health, a holistic healing center established 1986, located off I-80 in Auburn, featuring a collective of independent massage therapists offering a variety of modalities with steam and sauna included. Pathways to Health is at 530-888-6534. I will also be covering the Copenhagen. I will be going there in December and giving you daily reports on the news here, as well as blogging what's going on. So thank you so much for listening to Conversations on KVMR. It's 89.5 FM. And stay tuned for Tom Myers and So Many Roads, Music Magazine at 4 with Elisa Parker, 6 p.m. Evening News, Paul Emery and the Gang, 7 o'clock Democracy Now!, 8 o'clock Other Side, Mikhail Graham, and 10 o'clock Dan Elkin. Thanks again for listening. Until next week, be well.